Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches, and that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is funded by listeners like you. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about the program, please go to our website at thefinalwordradio.com. There you'll find archives so you can listen to any program you may have missed. Visit us on Facebook at The Final Word Radio and write us a note. We love hearing from our listeners. We'll provide other contact information at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. And now, Jim Andrews continues his study of God's Word.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us on The Final Word. We continue our exposition of the book of Proverbs. We've come to Proverbs chapter 27. We pick up today with verse 14. He who blesses his friend with a loud voice early in the morning, it will be reckoned a curse to him. The meaning of this proverb is debatable, but I believe the point is this. Unrestrained but premature praise so regularly signals a bad ending that it seems almost like a curse or a hex, as the saying goes. How many times do we see someone get up and lavish unstinting praise on a new pastor or new anybody? And one has that feeling, wait a minute, this is too much too soon. Let's give this some time and see how this person works out. But no, prematurely, they lay it on thick. And it does seem almost a curse or a hex, again, as the saying goes. So this, I believe, is a cautionary proverb, warning against premature praise. How many times have we seen this, for example, in the athletic world, where some phenom coming out of college or high school is hailed as the next so-and-so, and one can almost feel it's just like putting a curse on them. And lo, they've never even come close so far to living up to that billing. And they never do. Reminds me of the old wine ad. Sell no wine before it's time, is the idea here. Good wisdom. Verse 15, chapter 27. We've seen this before. A constant dripping on a day of steady rain, and a contentious woman are alike. You know, there's hardly anything as annoying as a steady drip, drip, drip. It's irritating. And the longer it goes on in the middle of the night, with the rain outside, it can be near maddening. Well, Solomon says a cantankerous wife is much like that to a man. The application for a male is to measure your bride before you take off with her. And it's also good wisdom for any would-be wife. Take note of this obnoxious habit and bury it before it has a chance to bury your marriage. This is not to say that men cannot be a pill. They certainly can. But it is a reminder to men, and Solomon writes first and foremost to young men, a woman can be a pain also. Verse 16. He who would restrain her, that is a contentious woman, restrains the wind and grasps oil with his right hand. Verse 16 adds a complimentary warning to verse 15. A quarrelsome wife is almost impossible to cure of her contentious habits. It goes so deep in her DNA. Imagine restraining the wind or grasping oil with your hand. Your local pastor has some idea right there of his counseling challenge. If that is a woman's disposition, avoid her like one with HIV. And if you already have one like that, remember your vows, grin and bear it, for heaven itself testifies to the trial that kind is. Remember, what is impossible for men to cure, God can heal. Don't leave her. Don't beat her. Do pray for her, hard, I would say, and wait on the Lord, brother. 27:17. I love this proverb. It's a favorite of mine. Iron sharpens iron. So one man sharpens another. Good men and good women, the Spirit of God tells us through Solomon, benefit greatly from associating with one another. The good habits and the good minds and the good skills call one another up and have a way of improving each other. Half the benefit of my years in academic training was outside the classroom, being around godly men, gifted guys, motivated men. Their gifts and example put a little more edge on me, and hopefully, maybe I contributed a little to some of them. This, by the way, is why we need the church. Folks, it is against God's plan, and it is inimical to our spiritual improvement and growth to go it alone. Too many out there do just that. I want to tell you something. Loners never really grow. They just wither, typically. It is the stimulation of others, Hebrews chapter 10, that provokes us to love and good works. It is the excellence that we experience around others that calls the best out of us. You know, every coach knows that. That's why they like to have two or three good players competing for a position. It brings the best out of both. Good competition makes good athletes better athletes. They sharpen each other. And so it is, my friends, in every arena of life, including the Christian life. You see, in isolation, there is not that stimulation that lifts us higher. Proverbs 27:18. He who tends the fig tree will eat its fruit, and he who cares for his master will be honored. It's like Paul said, 2 Timothy chapter 2. The farmer who attends his crops will naturally be the first to reap the produce and the benefit of it. Faithfulness to duty, whatever the duty is, brings its own reward. In time, those served will reward the dutifulness of the one who served them. That is true at the human as well as the divine level. So let any who would be wise take note. Verse 19, as in water face reflects face, so the heart of man reflects the man. Water is a kind of mirror. Look into it on a sunny day and see what you look like physically. The heart is to the character what water in a pond is to the face. Our hearts, meaning the matrix of the mind, the will, and the emotions, reveals our true character. Now, God knows our heart intimately and fully, though we ourselves know it only partially. But it tells the story, really. So in self-evaluation, we must look at the interior mirror, not at what we say, but at what we were thinking, not at what we do so much as what was our motive. Right there is where all self-examination must begin, in that interior mirror. The same place God's examination of us begins, though His examination is perfect, and ours may be very partial and flawed. But we must always start by looking at our mind, our thoughts, our will, our intentions, and our emotions, our feelings and affections. The interior mirror really tells the story. Verse 20, Sheol and Abaddon are never satisfied, nor are the eyes of men ever satisfied. Here is a commentary on what the Apostle John refers to as the lusts of the eyes. What our eyes have in common with death and destruction, that's a translation of Sheol and Abaddon, What our eyes have in common with those twin D's is an insatiable appetite for more and more and more. And that excess feeds eventually death and destruction, for inordinate longings pull us in the direction of those two. There is a Jewish midrash that says insightfully, "No man dies and has one half of what he wanted." What a commentary on human nature. For the natural man, life is a constant pursuit of objects that please the eye. And you know, when we get them, none of them satisfies for very long. Most of the thrill is in the chase, but once the object is in our grasp, it shortly loses its thrill like a cold can of soda shortly loses its chill in our hand. That is where knowing and walking with God changes things big time. The joy of living, when we know and walk with God, is no longer joined at the hip with the so fleeting joy of chasing and capturing the lust of the eyes. I know a particular guy, like so many others, whose life is so flatlined that the only way he can get a buzz is a new toy, another piece of eye candy. I'm sure you know your share, too. Predictably, this fellow won't have his toy long before he wants something better or another toy altogether different. His eye candy is a pleasure like a meal. Tastes great in the midst of consumption, but shortly thereafter, especially as soon as he's shown it to everybody he knows, he's hungry again and needs another fix. The human heart in its natural condition is always restless, casting up mud and dirt, and will ever be so until it finds its rest in God. Verse 21, chapter 27, "The crucible is for silver, and the furnace for gold. And a man is tested by the praise accorded to him." Solomon is telling us that as the crucible is used to refine and reveal fine metal like silver and the furnace for gold, so the praise that an individual receives works on the human character the way the crucible and the furnace works on those metals. God uses the praise or the adulation that we receive as a providential instrument to reveal what is in us and to refine what is precious. You see, some folk, when they are praised, get all puffed up. You almost can't afford to do it, because when somebody lays a little tribute on them, they become proud as peacocks, and they become divas and overbearing. In that case, praise exposes such folk as simply base metal at bottom. In other cases, praise humbles its object. They deflect, honestly, the glory to God. They acknowledge God's gifts, benefits, and acknowledge His favorable hand upon them. In fact, they even fear an excess of credit directed at themselves. They fear lest they be complicit in allowing themselves to be praised for work that God has done. You remember how Peter and John in Acts 3:12 were so careful to divert attention away from themselves when, by the power of Christ, they healed a lame man at the gate of the temple? You remember how Paul and Barnabas in Acts 14 implored the Lystrans not to treat them as deities when they had performed a miracle of healing that astounded the locals? So the next time someone praises you, just remember that an accolade in the providence of God tests and exposes your real character as much as adversity. Proverbs 27:22, "Though you pound a fool in a mortar with the pestle, along with crushed grain, yet his folly will not depart from him." There's another theme that we've seen redundantly, but deliberately in the mind of the Spirit of God. All of us, as we have noted, from time to time do foolish things. But those sins and errors do not per se render us fools. Just as occasionally setting out a small garden or cultivating a few plants in your backyard or on your patio does not make one a farmer. A fool is defined by the fact that his or her habits, habits of folly, are stubborn to the point of intractable. It seems that nothing can separate a bona fide fool from his folly. A fool can't learn from harsh experience. You can't tell a fool anything. He always, like a rubber band, returns to shape. He characteristically knows more than all of his would-be teachers. And you really can't correct him even with severe punishment. The lesson here, for the wise, I think, is that when you recognize the type of fool, hey, don't waste your breath, nor your time, nor lose sleep trying to fix what only God could fix. It won't be corrected by human method or agency, at least. It's a little like advising one not to try to cultivate a rock garden. If they're fool enough to do that, then just move on to more promising ground. Verses 23 through 27 are connected. Know well the condition of your flocks. Solomon, speaking in a pastoral era, advises, and pay attention to your herds, for riches are not forever, nor does the crown endure to all generations. When the grass disappears, the new growth is seen, and the herbs of the mountain are gathered in. The lambs will be for your clothing, and the goats will bring the price of a field. And there will be goat's milk enough for your food, for the food of your household and the sustenance of your maidens. Here is the counsel, wise counsel, of human due diligence with God's providential provision. Though it is a pastoral metaphor relating to an environment of flocks and herds, the principle applies even to a modern industrial and technological economy where we deal with markets and products and equipment rather than fields and flocks. Folks, the point is this. Take good care of what God has given us today as a hedge against the uncertainties of tomorrow. That is so wise. If we are wasteful and inattentive to our means of livelihood in prosperous times, we may wake up tomorrow in lean times and find ourselves in the grasp of poverty. But if in good times we take care of business, do it right, and we make every effort to conserve and preserve what we have been given, then we may find, when the good times no longer roll, that we are prepared for the bad times. That's not an axiom, but it is certainly more probable if we follow this advice. Now, this advice is no justification for us to get over anxious about securing our future and neglecting the pursuit of the kingdom of God for the pursuit of security for tomorrow. No, no, no. It is just a counsel to keep our eye on the ball, to do our due diligence in whatever God has given us to do, and not to take present prosperity, when it exists, for granted, and neglecting our duty today by living highly and too luxuriously. This brings us to Proverbs chapter 28, verse 1. Solomon says, "The wicked flee when no one is pursuing, but the righteous are bold as a lion." Here's a lesson. The condition of the human conscience, Solomon is telling us, can enervate or it can embolden. Battles have often been won not by superior weapons or manpower, but by the courage of an army occupying the high moral ground and the assurance of the justice of their cause. Sometimes that has been the difference. The weakness of the wicked is that their conscience condemns them. They're always looking over their shoulders because of that, and because they run scared of retribution retribution they know they deserve. The sound of a falling leaf or the leash shadow can, in many instances, unnerve them. But righteous men, knowing truly that God is with them, because their cause is truly just, they boldly forge ahead, fearing nothing. For even if things temporarily go wrong, they know, boy, this is important, that they are not in the wrong. So reassured by an approving conscience, they remain courageous, understanding that a setback is not a defeat when one is on the Lord's side. Proverbs 28, verse 2. By the transgression of a land, many are its princes. But by a man of understanding and knowledge, so it endures the land. What Solomon is teaching us here by way of wisdom is this. Wickedness is socially and politically destabilizing. Forces are unleashed and influences come into play when wickedness abounds that undermine a society. And one symptom of that phenomenon is unsteady leaders at the helm. Often, this leads to a political culture of constant corruption, intrigue, and usurpation or assassination. As others have pointed out, a people usually get the leaders they deserve. That is to say that a government at any given time tends to mirror the vices and virtue of its citizens, or especially bad government. Whether a city or a church, when the citizens and members have a collectively rebellious nature, you will generally see a lot of turnover at the top. If you see, for example, a church that has a lot of short-tenured senior pastors, there may be other factors, but there is a good possibility that the church is full of goats who always wind up butting their shepherds out of their sheep pen. It's hard for a modern president to make it two terms these days. But I at least never forget that our country, my love of it notwithstanding, was in fact born in rebellion. And that streak remains endemic to our culture, in my opinion at least. Not a good thing. Verse 3, Proverbs 28. A poor man who oppresses the lowly is like a driving rain which leaves no food. Here's what Solomon means. A heavy rain driven by wild winds may destroy thirsty crops rather than feed their roots. The general principle here is that whatever a leader hopes to gain by treating little and defenseless people harshly, that modus operandi is as counterproductive as a driving rain that leaves no crops. In the end, he loses too. Some powerful people, we all know, they just love to throw their weight around. They are contemptuous of the small folk who produce for them. The late Leona Helmsley, she said only the little people pay taxes. Such people are contemptuous of the small folk who produce for them. They don't get it. In knocking their legs out from under them, they're just shooting themselves in the foot, for they destroy the morale, if not the very lives, of the very people they depend on to help them be successful. But they're fools. They're not smart enough in the end to get it. Well, dear friends, thank you for joining us on The Final Word. God bless you and have a wonderful day.
The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about this program, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is info@thefinalwordradio.com. And our phone number is 503-699-9840. If this program is ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this outreach.